Good morning, everybody. So today is a, of course, it's the day long, and the theme is Recollections of Ajahn Chah. It's actually the first time I've taught a day long at Spirit Rock. So this is a new experience for me, and we'll see how it goes. Considering the theme of Recollections of Ajahn Chah, then I could give a bit of background for my own connection with Ajahn Chah. I first heard of him in probably late 1973. I was practicing in a monastery on the outskirts of Bangkok, where I actually took a temporary ordination for 3 or 4 months, just to get a bit of experience and go on my way. I had places to go and things to do, and then I kept hearing of Ajahn Chah. I kept hearing of the forest monks up in the northeast of Thailand. So that in early 1974, I took my ordination was the beginning of January, and I don't know, late January, early February or something like that, I went up to the northeast of Thailand to pay respects to Ajahn Chah. And when I arrived at the monastery, I went in. It was early morning. Monks had just finished their alms round, and there's this scene of stillness, but then activity, and the monks are all quiet, going about there. Coming back from alms round, I went up and paid respects to Ajahn Chah, and did my 3 bows, and then he just sort of looked at me and said, "If you want to stay here, you have to stay at least 5 years." So that was my introduction to Ajahn Chah as a person. And oh, excellent. Excellent. I was actually going to bring a big one this morning. How do we get it? Oh, thank you, Jen. Let's give a... How do we do it? I'm not sure. Can we get it? Yes. Maybe if it were propped up on the side there, that would... I think that's... Without some special props. Give me... Is that going to work? Kovilo, could you pull that out?
Yeah.
Pull that forward.
Is that okay?
Pull that forward. No, the with the antennas.
Oh,
that's going to work.
Is that all right?
Yeah, that's going to work. That's perfect. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you, Ajahn.
Wow, thank you.
Pleasure to bring him in. He says, I'm kind of big this morning.
But yeah, he's a big presence. I was contemplating bringing we have a large picture of Ajahn Chah up in our new building, and we're thinking about bringing it, but then our van is off with a group of monks, and it was a bit of a scramble to get transportation together. We hardly had enough space for ourselves and a cup of tea this morning in the vehicle. So the image that we were going to bring was it's actually a needlepoint. It was offered villagers at Bung Wai, which is where the International Forest Monastery is. It's something that they started doing this last year or so. And various people have been doing these needle points of Ajahn Chah, and it'll take 6 months, 9 months, a year, to do a real act of faith. And then they just finish this one particular person that just finished theirs. They've been working on it 9 months and then just came and offered it to bring to Abhayagiri. So it's, well, we didn't bring it down. So we have this one, which is a wonderful image of Ajahn Chah. And as we go through the day, I'll try to, I've probably got way more material than I can possibly cover and still have time to do sitting and walking. But I'll try to hit some points along the way of Ajahn Chah's life, Ajahn Chah's training, how he trained, how he also changed during his life, or some of the difficulties he also experienced. And I'm going to be trying to do it by using material that is mostly not available to... it's not in books yet. It's not... a lot of it's in the kind of manuscript form that we have. There's a Ajahn Jayasaro has been working on for many years. He was responsible for the biography that was created at the for the funeral ceremonies of Ajahn Chah, and it has yet to be put into English. And because one of the reasons he realized is that you can't actually do a translation. You need to do a whole new book that is geared for a Western audience. So that's been taking time, and he's a procrastinator. He's been living on his own now, and he said he's... I was talking to him recently, and he said that now he's... with all the years of solitude, he's been turning into a world-class procrastinator. So, so that, but he's been working on a lot of that, and so I want to use some of that material, and then also use some. I pulled together some of Ajahn Chah's instructions on meditation, so that when we do the meditations, rather than me doing instruction, then I'll be relying on Ajahn Chah's instructions in meditation. So that that'll be the overall scheme of the day. And because I have never done a day long here, then I actually had to email Ajahn Amaro and say, what do you do anyway? What am I supposed to do when I get there? So that I'll follow. He sent me an email and gave me a basic outline of how he usually runs a day long, so that I'll follow that that kind of format, that schedule, more or less. And I think one of the, you know, to begin with, I'll just take some things from Ajahn Chah's life. These are recollections of Ajahn Chah, and to get a sense of who he was, where he came from. And I can only just skim and hit points. But hopefully it'll get a flavor of how somebody who had such an effect on so many people. Because, say, now in the West, there must be, I don't know, 15, 20 monasteries that are affiliated with Ajahn Chah. In Thailand, there must be 300, I would think. When there's a gathering, once a year, on the anniversary of his death and cremation, there's a gathering to pay respects to him, and there's usually about a 1,000 monks show up, and several hundred nuns, 10,000 lay people, 12. It's hard to count when it gets to those numbers. So that and they all live at Ajahn Chah's monastery during that time, usually under the trees. It's Ajahn Chah was very convenient. He was a good organizer, so that when he died, he died at a very convenient time. It was sort of the beginning of the cool season, when it's not so hot that it's difficult to gather, and it's not it's sort of early enough after the rains have ended that there's still enough water in the wells to supply the wells with water to deal with all these people. They'll all be living there, and there'll be people coming from all around the country every day. So it's usually about a week of practice and teachings being given throughout that time, and you see the impact that Ajahn Chah had in Thailand, and then of course in our own way in the West, the impact and inspiration that he's given to so many people. So I'll just do a bit of reading from different places. Ajahn Chah was born into an affectionate and respected household, one of the wealthier families in a close-knit community. The northeastern villages of those days, isolated by forests and vulnerable to the vagaries of the weather and the caprice of spirits, put great store on sharing, generosity, and harmony. The model was of an extended family, and over the years, marriages between inhabitants of a village tended to make it one in fact. Houses were made of wood, roofed with grass thatch, and raised on stilts as protection from floods and wild animals. They were placed close together with no fixed boundaries between them. Life was conducted on a large open space upstairs, with rooms used only for sleeping. People not only heard their neighbors' family dramas, they could see them as well. But there was no concept of privacy, much less a desire for it. The villagers subscribed to respect for monks, elders, and spirits, consideration for the feelings of others, and a sense of shame. They relished laughter and conversation. Ajahn Chah grew up with a strong sense of community and place, and the gift of the gab. The adjective that was often used to describe Ajahn Chah in his old age, ebullient, is the one that comes most readily to mind when picturing him as a child. He was a chunky, exuberant young lad, and yet, at the same time, keen and perceptive. Nobody's fool. He was full of fun and vigor, with the sunny, buoyant disposition so common to the Laos. And that's the area of Thailand that Ajahn Chah grew up in, is a Lao-speaking and more Lao culture. The northeastern Thai is a Lao. Their roots are more in Laos. And actually, when I first arrived in Thailand, northeast of Thailand, we're first setting up the monastery for the international community. The old people oftentimes say, rather than saying, "Oh, I'll be going down to Bangkok," or "My children are going down to Bangkok," they would say, "Oh, they're going to Thailand." So it's a distinct language and culture. But even then, he showed a glint of steel in his ways. He was both a talker and a doer, the natural leader of his group of friends, the one whom everyone wanted to be close to and without whom all games and adventures seemed dull. Ajahn Chah bore the round face and flat lion's nose common to his race. More distinctively, his mouth was unusually wide and compelling, as if destined one day to have memorable things to say. While in charming contrast to the powerful symmetry of his face, his right ear was larger than the left. His childhood friends remember Ajahn Chah's mildness. They say he never enforced his dominance with bullying or coercion. No one can recall him in a fight. He was a mediator in his companions' disputes and, from an early age, was drawn by the yellow robe. He relates a childhood memory of playing the role of a monk. He would sit sternly on an old bamboo bed with a pakoma, it's an all-purpose cloth that the villagers use. They usually wrap it around. They do all sorts of things with it. It's usually wrapped around their waist. With a pakoma draped over his left shoulder like a robe. And his friends would play the parts of the laity. The mealtime is probably the only event in the monk's daily life that is interesting enough to lend itself to drama, and it was that which the children would enact. Ajahn Chah would ring a bell, and his friends would bring a tray of fruit and cool water. After bowing three times, they would offer it to him meekly. He, in turn, would give them the five precepts of the Buddhist layperson and a blessing. So these are very early days. It was at the age of 9 that Ajahn Chah asked permission from his parents to move out of the family home and into the local monastery. It was a common practice for parents to entrust sons to the monks, but rare for a boy to volunteer. Many years later, Ajahn Chah spoke of his decision in the following way. Well, the causes and conditions were there. As a boy, I had a fear of committing evil actions. I was always a straightforward lad. I was honest, and I didn't tell lies. When there were things to be shared out, I was considerate. I would take less than my due. That basic nature just kept maturing until one day I said to myself, "Go to the monastery." I asked my friends if they had ever thought of doing the same thing, and none of them had. The idea just arose naturally. I'd say it was the fruit of past actions. As time went on, wholesome qualities steadily grew inside me until one day they led me to decide and do as I did. On another occasion, in a more humorous vein, Ajahn Chah told some lay disciples that he had become a monastery child because he was tired of watering the family tobacco fields and because the humdrum daily round of chores was so tedious and repetitive. And he says, "I was just a small little child. I'd never smoked tobacco in my life. But even so, first thing in the morning, as soon as I got up, I was driven off to the fields to water tobacco plants, hundreds of them. It was infuriating." As one of Ajahn Chah's sisters remembers it, a small accident brought things to a head. Him going to live in the monastery wasn't arranged by our parents. It was his own idea. One day he was helping his brothers and sisters pounding rice, but he wasn't putting much heart into it. Well, it so happened the pounder slipped out, and we had to drive in a wedge to keep it firm. He wouldn't help. But then, while the rest of us were doing it, he got hit by the wood while we were using as a mallet. It must have hurt him because he got angry and shouted out, "That's it, I'm going to go and be a monk." So that's 9 years old. He ordained as a novice, and he did his studies, and then when he was around the time he was 16, his teacher at the monastery would take him over to their house, his family home, and he would it ended up that his teacher had fallen in love with Ajahn Chah's sister, and then ended up disrobing and to marry Ajahn Chah's sister. So that put some turmoil into Ajahn Chah's mind, and then with just 16 years old, there's a draw to the world. So he left being a novice and went back and helped out with the family fields, and it's an agrarian society. And so then he also had his own sort of attraction to a girl. He said, and then he relates this himself. When I was 18, I liked a girl. She liked me too. And as these things go, after some time of liking her, I fell deeply in love. I wanted to marry her. I daydreamed about having her by my side, helping me out in the fields, making a living together. Then one day on my way home from work, I met my best friend, Put, on the road. He said, "Cha, I'm taking the lady." When I heard those words, I went completely numb. I was in a state of shock for hours afterwards. I remembered the prediction of an astrologer that I would have no wife but many children. At that time, I wondered how it could be possible. And then the narrative goes on. Simply, and with the unquestioned prerogative that parents of his age and culture possessed, Put's father and his wife had decided that their two stepchildren should marry. There was no more to be said. The reasons were pragmatic, economic. If Put married Jai was the girl's name, if Put married Jai, the family would be saved a bride price they could ill afford. They had just acquired land some distance from the village that should not be left fallow. The young couple could move out there and farm it together. Ajahn Chah, despite the coming of the rains, must have felt his life suddenly beached in a dry and desolate land. But other than trying to reconcile himself to the situation, what could he do? It made no sense to be angry with Put. His friend had not plotted behind his back and was painfully embarrassed by the whole affair. But this disappointment was a profound one, a sharp and hurtful lesson in the uncertainties that bedevil human affairs. Where should you, where could you, place your trust? Ajahn Chah maintained his friendship with Put, and indeed it was to last for the rest of Ajahn Chah's life. But with Jai, he had to be more circumspect. His feelings could not be denied by an act of will. Even after becoming a monk, if Ajahn Chah saw her in the monastery, he would have to do his utmost to avoid a meeting that might stir up painful emotions. Ajahn Chah admitted that for the first 7 years of his monkhood, it was impossible to completely let go of his thoughts of Jai. Perhaps after all, by some miracle, she became free. The same tantalizing scenarios periodically recurred in his mind, the same facile happy endings. Could he then, in such a case, remain in the robes? He didn't know. It was only when he finally left his familiar surroundings and through meditation practice gained a method of stilling his thoughts and seeing them in perspective that the fantasies faded. In later years, as abbot of Wat Nongpapong, describing to the monks the drawbacks of sensual desire, he would often talk of the debt of gratitude he owed to Put. If he hadn't married Mae Jai, then I probably wouldn't be here today, he would say. Perhaps. At the same time, one can't help but assume that if there had not been this particular obstacle to a conventional married life, another would surely have emerged. He says, "I was fed up. I didn't want to live with my parents. The more I thought about it, the more fed up I became. I just wanted to go off by myself the whole time. But to where, I didn't know. I felt like that for a number of years. I was fed up, but not with anything in particular. I just wanted to go somewhere and be alone. These were the feelings I had before I became a monk. I wasn't fully conscious of them, But they were there all the same, all of the time. Because at the age of 20 is when you can be ordained as a fully ordained monk. And it's also the time when you're up for the military draft as well in Thailand. So that oftentimes this is very much the case where they wait and see, am I drafted? Do I go into the military? Do I become a monk for a period of time? So this next section. Ajahn Chah's name was missing from the list of young men from Ubon called up for national service. He was now free to ask for admission into the monkhood. But by this time, his ideas about becoming a monk had changed. He no longer considered it simply in terms of making merit for his parents, an expression of the gratitude he felt towards them. These were certainly noble aims, but he desired something more, something that could resolve the dis-ease in his heart. Lay life seemed hollow and tedious. Perhaps the monastic life could lead him to meaning and peace. He decided to become a monk for an indefinite period. His mother and father were pleased. They had enough children to help with the farm work, and it was auspicious to have a son in robes. The admission ceremony took place on the 26th of April, 1939, at Wat Kaw Nai, the local monastery. Prakru Intisarakun was Ajahn Chah's preceptor and conferred on him the monk's name of Subhuto, which means well-developed. Ajahn Chah spent the first 2 years of his monastic life at Wat Kaw, so that he's in his home village, studying the teachings, and he retook the first level of monastic studies, Nak Tham Tri, which is, he would have done that as a novice as well. And then he gives speaks himself. When I first became a monk, I didn't train myself, but I had faith. Maybe I was born with it, I don't know. At the end of the rains retreat, the monks and novices who joined the Sangha at the same time as me, all disrobed. I thought, what's wrong with them? But I didn't dare to say anything, because I still didn't trust my own feelings. My friends were excited at leaving, but to me, they seemed foolish. I considered how difficult it was to enter the Sangha, and how easy to disrobe. I thought how lacking in merit they must be to look on the worldly path as more beneficial than that of Dhamma. That's how I looked at it. But I said nothing. I kept my thoughts to myself. I'd watch my fellow monks and novices come and go. Sometimes before disrobing, they try on their lay clothes and parade up and down. I thought they were completely insane. But they thought they looked good, that their clothes were smart, and they talked about the things they were going to do after they disrobed. I didn't dare to tell them that they'd got it all wrong, because I didn't know how long my own faith would last. After my friends disrobed, I became resigned. You're on your own now, I said to myself, pulled out my copy of the Patimokkha, which are the 227 training rules of the monk, which many of us will tend to memorize and then recite fortnightly to the community. Pulled out my copy of the Patimokkha and started to memorize it. It was easier than before with nobody teasing me or fooling around. I was able to concentrate on it fully. I didn't say anything, but I made a resolution that from that day onwards until the end of my life, whether it be at the age of 70 or 80 or whatever, I would try to practice with a constant appreciation, not allow my efforts to slacken or my faith to weaken, to be consistent. That is an extremely difficult task, and I didn't dare to tell anyone else. People came and went, and I said nothing. I merely watched impassively. But in my mind, I was thinking, they don't see clearly. However, Ajahn Chah had his own problems. Food was a major craving in those early days. And he says, it's not a smooth ride when you're practicing. You suffer. The first and second years are especially hard. The young monks and the small novices really go through it. I suffered myself a lot. If you've got a problem with food, it's rough. I became a monk when I was 20. That's the age when, who can deny it? You really enjoy food and sleep. Sometimes I just sit there quietly dreaming about things I'd like to eat. pounded Denny bananas, green papaya salad, all kinds of things. The saliva would be flowing like a river in my mouth. Remember one story he told when I remember him telling that, where he was still in the village monastery and using money, having money, and then going to a local shop, noodle shop, and which is a big kind of treat, and especially if you're from the villages in Thailand, sort of the Chinese noodles, it's a big deal. And he said, yeah, I went into that shop. I said, close the doors, I'm going to eat noodles today. I said, and somebody asked him, he said, well, how much did you eat? He said, I had 7 bowls. He said, Ajahn Chah's father, Poma, was proud to have a son in the robes, and whenever Ajahn Chah visited home, would always encourage him in his efforts and make the requests. Please don't disrobe, Venerable Sir. I invite you to stay as a monk indefinitely. And then Ajahn Jayasaro makes a comment. This is a deliberately literal translation. It is hard to convey in English the tenor of a conversation between a Thai monk and his parents. Filial piety is greatly stressed in Thai society, and the relationship between parents and children is generally warm and close. Yet, when the son becomes a monk, their way of relating to each other instantly and radically changes. The parents are now lay people. They sit on a lower seat at a respectful distance. They use honorifics when referring to their son and humble personal pronouns when referring to themselves. There is a formality and ritual air to their conversations that one from another culture might find odd and somewhat unnatural, and yet for a canny observer, there is no question that behind the form, the deep affection remains intact. It is perhaps precisely because of the closeness of family relations that such a stilted form is deemed necessary. Now, as he lay weak and shrunk, this is Ajahn Chah's father is old and sick and on his deathbed. Now, as he lay weak and shrunken on his deathbed, Poma made the request once more. It was difficult for him to speak. He said, "You've made the right choice. Don't change it. Lay life is full of all kinds of pain and difficulties. There's no real peace or contentment in it. Stay as a monk." On previous occasions, Ajahn Chah had always kept silent, his head slightly bowed, showing respect, but an unwillingness to announce such a commitment. This time, however, in a quiet voice, he replied, "No, I won't disrobe. Why should I do that?" His father's face relaxed into a warm, contented smile, and he drifted off to sleep. This would have been about Ajahn Chah would have been a monk for about 6 years or maybe 7. I can't remember exactly. When Poma discovered that Ajahn Chah's exams would take place shortly, he urged him to return to his monastery. But this request was refused. Instead, Ajahn Chah helped to nurse his father for the 13 more days and nights that the old man lingered on. It was December, when the days of a drained, subdued tone and a cold wind blows down across the northeast from China. When first thing in the morning, everyone lights fires outside their houses to warm themselves by, and jewharp kites, anchored high in the air, utter their melancholy cry throughout the night. Finally, one day, Poma's labored breath stopped, making the wind outside the house sound even louder. It seemed clear that the death of Poma precipitated a crisis in Ajahn Chah's life. While nursing his father, truths that Ajahn Chah had been studying academically found a grounding in his experience. The human body is a mere conglomeration of the elements of solidity, fluidity, heat, and vibration. The inevitability of old age, sickness, and death. prominent features of passages learned by rote in the monastery, he now saw as concise. Undeniable articulations of the nature of his own father's life, and such teachings found a deep resonance in his heart. On his return to Wat Ba Nong Lak, which is where he was studying, after the funeral, Ajahn Chah's concentration on his studies was frequently interrupted by vivid images of those days. The sufferings of his father's emaciated body in its final days, life's abrupt cessation, the stiff and doll-like corpse his father had become, and its growing smell, the shards of bone amongst the cremation ashes, such memories must have welled up within him constantly. He felt imbued by a profound and sober sense of sadness, determined to dedicate his life to the Dhamma and to be free of the cycle of conditioned existence. He made a solemn resolve, and this is Ajahn Chah's words, "I dedicate my body and mind, my whole life, to the practice of the Lord Buddha's teachings in their entirety. I will realize the truth in this lifetime. I will let go of everything and follow the teachings. No matter how much suffering and difficulty I have to endure, I will persevere. Otherwise, there will be no end of my doubts. I must make this life as even and continuous as a single day and night. I will abandon attachments to mind and body and follow the Buddha's teachings until I know the truth for myself." I think that was one of Ajahn Chah's probably singular qualities, is his tremendous resolution, incredible dedication, that willingness to just take things to take them to their end, not just do things in a half-hearted way, and of course that's why he's turned into such a great teacher for so many people. For right now, I think that we could probably have a period of sitting meditation. Although I'm looking at something else. Well, maybe one last thing, because that Ajahn Chah then went from that time. He started to wander as a. He wanted to. He didn't want to stay in a village monastery. He didn't want to stay in a study monastery. He wanted to practice. And there weren't many practice monasteries to go to. There weren't many places that were so focused on meditation. He wasn't quite sure where to go or what to do. So, but he'd heard, of course, in the culture and in there is this passed on knowledge of, yeah, there are these teachers in these different places, so he went wandering with a friend of his, they ended up in central Thailand, which is, it's a long walk. In those days, if you were a monk and you just put your alms bowl, your robes, a mosquito net, and a umbrella, and then you wandered and wandered from village to village, and then practiced in places that seemed suitable. And he did a very good monastery in central Thailand, and that's when he started to hear about Ajahn Mun, who's considered the kind of great reviver of the forest tradition in the northeast of Thailand, and a great teacher who inspired many other teachers, and Ajahn Chah went, the monastery that he was staying at was Wat Khao Wongkot, and he, Ajahn Jayasaro, begins this chapter with a verse from the, or this section with a verse from the Dhammapada. An intelligent person, even though associated with a wise man only for a moment, quickly understands the Dhamma, just as the tongue knows the taste of soup. So during his stay at Wat Khao Wongkot, Ajahn Chah first heard the name of the monk who was to become a legendary figure in Thailand, the most revered monk of his generation. Today, on the shrines of houses, shops, and offices throughout the country, a photograph of Lumpu Man. Lumpu is like venerable grandfather. It's a special term of reverence and respect. Of Lumpu Man can commonly be seen in a place of honor just below the Buddha himself. In it, you see a slight figure dressed in the somber robes of the forest monk, standing almost ghost-like amongst unearthly trees, his hands clasped in front of him, radiating an austere composure and an ethereal stillness. He seems to be looking right through the camera and into the deepest recesses of your heart. It is an inspiring but discomforting picture. It challenges all that you take for granted. The impression of Lumpu Man conveyed by the stories and anecdotes related by those who knew him is startlingly reminiscent of the accounts of great monks found in the Buddhist scriptures. Even after making allowances for the bias of loyal disciples, such comparisons are not fanciful. Lumpu Man was, for all 60 or so years of his monastic career, an exemplar of the ascetic peripatetic existence that we associate with the monks of the Buddha's time. He was in his mid-70s before he spent two consecutive rain retreats, in the same monastery. Only at the very end of his life, when he could no longer walk, did he give up his daily alms round. His psychic powers were apparently stupendous. His wisdom, to use the traditional simile, was as sharp and penetrating as a diamond sword. He is credited with the highest realization of Dhamma. For most Thais, Lumpu Man represents the incontrovertible proof that enlightenment exists and is attainable in this day and age. The forest tradition has never disappeared from Thailand, but before Lumpu Man, forest monks were always scattered in small isolated communities that possessed little sense of a wider tradition. These sanghas tended to be centered around a charismatic teacher, and after his death rarely survived for more than two or three generations. There are no records to tell us how many such groups have assembled and dispersed in the last 700 years. We will never know how many enlightened beings have come and gone. In the words of the Buddha himself, like birds crossing the sky, they left no tracks. Lumpu Man, however, lived at the beginning of a more connected, informed, and time-ridden age. Accounts of his practice and teachings have been recorded in many books. A number of fine training monasteries have been established by his disciples throughout the Northeast, which attracts visitors and pilgrims from all over the country. He may be an unfathomable figure to many, but he is not obscure. The high standards maintained by the monks of his lineage and the integrity and prowess of his greatest disciples has ensured that today there is a respect for forest monks that has not existed in the country since the Sukhothai period, which is around 1200 or 1300. It would not be an exaggeration to say that the Thai forest lineage as we know it was established almost single-handedly by Lumpu Man. But in the late 1940s, he was still relatively unknown. Throughout his monastic life, Lumpu Man shunned fame and status like a pestilent disease. 15 years earlier, while staying at Wat Chedi Luang, one of the oldest and most prestigious monasteries in Chiang Mai, he had received a letter from the powers that be in Bangkok informing him of his appointment as abbot. The next day he disappeared into the mountains and was not seen in the city again for a number of years. Lumpu Man was often a fierce and exacting teacher. His scoldings were famous. In his disciple Lumpa Mahabua's memorable phrase, they, quote, shriveled your liver, unquote. And yet he inspired a quiet but intense devotion from all who knew him. Now, Ajahn Chah learned from an old layman at Wat Khao Wongkot, Lumpuman had returned to the northeast after 10 years of solitary wandering in the north, and a large group of monks had gathered around him in the Puphan Mountains of Sikonikon. Ajahn Chah's plans for the cold season crystallized. At the end of the retreat, Ajahn Chah, together with three other monks and novices and two laymen, set off on the long walk back to the northeast. They broke the journey at Bangkor and, after a few days' rest, began a 250-kilometer hike northwards. By the 10th day, they had reached the elegant white stupa of That Phanom, an ancient pilgrimage spot on the banks of the Mekong, and paid homage to the Buddha's relics enshrined there. They continued their walk in stages, by now finding forest monasteries along the way in which to spend the night. Even so, it was an arduous trek, and the novice and the layman asked to turn back. The group consisted of just three monks and a layman when they finally arrived at Wat Phu Nong Na Nai, the home of Lumpuman. As they walked into the monastery, Ajahn Chah was immediately struck by its tranquil and secluded atmosphere. The central area in which stood a small meeting hall was immaculately swept, and the few monks they caught sight of were attending to their daily chores silently, with a measured and composed gracefulness. There was something about the monastery that was like no other that he had been in before. The silence was strangely charged and vibrant. Ajahn Chah and his companions were received politely, and after being advised where to put up their mosquito nets, took a welcome bath to wash off the grime of the road. In the evening, the three young monks, their double-layered outer robes folded neatly over their left shoulders, minds fluctuating between keen anticipation and cold fear, made their way to the wooden sala, to pay respects to Lumpuman. Crawling on his knees toward the great master, flanked on both sides by the resident monks, Ajahn Chah approached a slight and aged figure with an indomitable diamond-like presence. It is easy to imagine Lumpuman's bottomless eyes and his deeply penetrating gaze boring into Ajahn Chah as he bowed three times and sat down at a suitable distance. Most of the monks were sitting with their eyes closed in meditation. One sat slightly behind Lumpuman, slowly fanning away the evening's mosquitoes. As Ajahn Chah glanced up, he would have noticed how prominently Lumpuman's collarbone jutted through the pale skin above his robe and how his thin mouth, stained red with betel juice, formed such an arresting contrast to the strange luminosity of his presence. As is the time-honored custom among Buddhist monks, Lumpuman first asked the visitors how long they had been in the robes, the monasteries they had practiced in, and the details of their journey. Did they have any doubts about the practice? Ajahn Chah swallowed. Yes, he did. He had been studying Vinaya texts, those are the books of discipline, Vinaya texts with great enthusiasm, but had become discouraged. The discipline seemed too detailed to be practical. It didn't seem possible to keep every single rule. What should one's standard be? Lumpuman advised Ajahn Chah to take the two guardians of the world, Hiri in Pali, which is conscience, and Otapa, intelligent fear of consequences, as his basic principle. In the presence of those two virtues, he said, everything else would follow. He then began to discourse on the threefold training of virtue, meditation, and wisdom. The four roads to success, that's desire, effort, application of mind, and investigation, and the five spiritual powers, faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, wisdom. Eyes half closed, his voice becoming stronger and faster as he proceeded, as if he was moving into a higher and higher gear. With an absolute authority, he described the way things truly are and the path to liberation. Ajahn Chah and his companions sat completely enwrapped. Ajahn Chah later said that although he had spent an exhausting day on the road, hearing Lumpuman's Dhamma talk made all of his weariness disappear. His mind became peaceful and clear, and he felt as if he was floating in the air above his seat. It was late at night before Lumpu Mun called the meeting to an end, and Ajahn Chah returned to his mosquito net aglow. On the second night, Lumpu Mun gave more teachings, and Ajahn Chah felt that he had come to the end of his doubts about the practice that lay ahead. He felt a joy and rapture in the Dhamma that he had never known before. Now what remained was for him to put his knowledge into practice. Indeed, one of the teachings that had inspired him the most on those two evenings was this injunction to make himself a witness to the truth. But the most clarifying explanation, one that gave him the necessary context or basis for practice that he had been hitherto lacking, was of a distinction between the mind itself and transient states of mind which arose and passed away within it. And then Ajahn Chah says himself, Lumpu Mun said they're merely states. Through not understanding that point, we take them to be real, to be the mind itself. In fact, they're all just transient states. As soon as he said that, things suddenly became clear. Suppose there's happiness present in the mind. It's a different kind of thing. It's on a different level to the mind itself. If you see that then you can stop, you can put things down. When conventional realities are seen for what they are, then it's ultimate truth. Most people lump everything together as the mind itself, but actually there are states of mind together with the knowing of them. If you understand that point, then there's not a lot to do. On the third day, Ajahn Chah paid his respects to Lumpu Mun and led his small group off into the lonely forest of Phupan once more. He left the monastery behind him, never to return again, but with his heart full of an inspiration that would stay with him for the rest of his life.